Welcome to Fresh Research, a podcast from the nonprofit Times. We explore some of the most interesting and sometimes provocative findings focused on the world of nonprofits. Thanks for tuning in. Here at the nonprofit Times, we see tons of great fresh research. So in each episode, we take a recent study or survey and have a conversation with the authors about what they found and why they think it's important for charities. We'll also give away some books and give you access to other valuable information from the nonprofit Times.
Nonprofits have been making a big push for a universal charitable deduction for years. The CARES Act created a temporary tax deduction for charitable gifts up to $300 for single or married filers in 2020. Congress extended that into 2021 and increased the deduction to $600 for married couples. Now, two professors at the University of Virginia believe that adding a tax subsidy could increase civic engagement in a time of income inequality and political polarization. Hi, I'm Mark Arivna for the Nonprofit Times, and in this episode, we'll talk about the paper, The Charitable Tax Deduction and Civic Engagement, by Andrew Hayashi and Justin Hopkins. They propose that all taxpayers with adjusted gross income of less than the national median would get the community contribution credit. Hayashi is a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law, and Hopkins is a professor at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. The refundable tax credit would be equal to 90% of contributions capped at $500. It would apply for donations to 501c3 charities, but also 501c4 social welfare organizations, which currently are not eligible for deductible contributions. In 2018, the national median adjusted gross income was almost $44,000. And now, here's my conversation with Andrew Hayashi and Justin Hopkins.
How did you come up with this proposal? Can you kind of give a brief synopsis for our listeners on what it would do and what your paper proposes?
Justin, maybe I'll go ahead and just frame the question where they came from, and maybe you can talk about the proposal.
Yeah, I think I can tell the backstory about how sort of we got started on this.
Sure.
And then you can talk more about the details of the proposal, I suppose, because that's more of the area that you worked on. So being a business school professor, I teach a course at the law school as well. And I've gotten to know Andrew over the years, and we've talked several times. Although we've never really written a paper together, we have similar interests. And so after class one time, I think I walked over to your office, and I walked around and I saw that you were in your office. And so we kind of just started talking about things we were interested in and projects we could potentially work on together. And this was one that sort of, I think, piqued your interest. And where it came about is that just my own personal experience being involved actually with a food bank here locally. And one thing that sort of got me is interested in how people can become involved in their communities, because it just seems like the trend today is, you talk about how divisive we are as a people, as a nation. How can we bring people together is something that seems to be an important topic in today's world. And as I was volunteering at this food bank, it just kind of struck me that the people who volunteer there were often donors of the food bank as well. And if you're thinking about levers to induce people to get engaged in their community, it's not like Congress can mandate community service for people. But one lever that Congress does have is the ability to provide incentives, tax incentives, to encourage people to donate and to contribute to their local community. And in so doing, I thought maybe, it would encourage people to also get involved, to volunteer, to get more involved in their community. So maybe this was like a policy lever that we could use to come about to broaden civic engagement and get people just more involved in their charities. So this is, I think, where the conversation started. If correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, but that was my recollection of our initial conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there's always an element of sort of serendipity that how these projects get started, we find you have similar interests. But let me say a little bit more about, I think, the bigger trends that we felt like this proposal was tapping into and why I got interested in that I think, help explain why the proposal has the features it does. And that's, I think, as Justin and I were talking, reflecting on two concerning trends that I think we've been observing over the last, say, 30 or 40 years that are much discussed among sort of legal academics anyway, but other sort of observers. One is growing income and wealth inequality. It's just sort of front page stuff all the time. And the second is this feeling that Justin was alluding to about a lack of individual connection to community, whether it's sort of local faith communities or charitable organizations or unions or just other sites where people get together outside of, for example, other sites where people work together other than sort of government or interacting in the marketplace. And so there are these two things going on, both of which we're worried about. And as Justin said, tax policy, I mean, I tend to see tax is sort of my hammer. And so I see for everything. And we got to thinking that tax policy actually may have a role here in ameliorating both the income inequalities we see and then the sort of alienation people feel from local communities. And one way it can do that is by encouraging greater involvement, greater charitable giving, which we think leads to greater volunteerism. And as we show in the paper, greater civic engagement more broadly. So ultimately what we propose in the paper is reforming the incentives for charitable giving. We don't necessarily have in mind an expansion of tax incentives for giving. Sort of the existing regime is a deduction that's available for individuals, as your listeners well know, up to a certain threshold amount. And it's that deduction is beneficial if you're the kind of person who itemizes your deductions. That deduction is more valuable if you're in a higher tax bracket. So it tends to, most of the benefits of the federal incentives for charitable giving tend to flow to higher income individuals and the charities that they support. It's sort of a natural consequence of it being a deduction. So we propose making the primary incentive for charitable giving be a tax credit. And we're definitely not the first people to have proposed this. The benefit of there being a credit for giving rather than a deduction is that, a $100 tax credit is worth the same no matter what tax bracket you're in, and it's worth the same whether you itemize your deduction or not. So there's sort of it doesn't have that regressive effect that a charitable deduction has. So we propose extending it to all households, a $500 tax credit to all households whose income falls below a certain amount. In terms of what we would do to the deduction, we have a couple thoughts in the paper about how to reform that. But the meat of the proposal is to extend a tax credit for low and middle income households so they can support the charities and social welfare organizations that they want to be involved in and get a tax benefit for doing that.
And so it would differ, like for instance, right now there's a universal charitable deduction until the end of the year. And that's been a big push by charities on the Hill is making that permanent in some way. This would be different in that it would be a credit, obviously, and it would be more focused on lower and middle income in order to those folks who don't itemize.
Yeah. So some of what we're responding to are the innovative ways that Congress has been, responding to the pandemic with this sort of deduction available to anybody that we see the last few administrations being willing to tinker with that. And we share that spirit of wanting to extend an incentive to the low end of the distribution, even people who take the standard deduction. So our primary difference is, yes, it's a credit. It's not a deduction. We think it's important that it not be a temporary change to tax law, that it needs to be sort of a permanent change, because we want the nonprofit sector to recognize and respond to this new class of charitable donors in the way they set about raising money and how they set priorities. And I think the concern with the deduction, in addition to the fact it's still, a deduction, and so it depends on your tax rate for the benefits, is that it's who knows, if it's going to stay or go. And so we think the permanence is an important feature. We'd also extend it to not just donations to 501c3s, but also, we think, social welfare organizations as well, 501c4s.
Yeah, that's the other thing I wanted to talk about, because it kind of jumped out at me, was C4s. Why would they be included in this? Because right now they're not eligible for charitable deductions necessarily, and they're more politically active on issues, or they're, I should say, they're allowed to be more politically active. They can actually endorse candidates. Would that open up a kind of can of worms, is allowing C4s to get that deduction as well?
Well, I guess it's a can of worms or a can of something else, depending on how you think of it. I think, you know, when we think about sort of mitigating economic inequality in the long run, that it's not only sort of tax rates that need to change, but sort of our politics that need to change. And so the fact that, you know, C4s can engage in more political activity than others, or, you know, even just, you know, that includes things like, I think, Rotary clubs and, sort of volunteer organizations that, you know, maybe don't qualify as charities, that there are a lot of benefits to those organizations that are sort of non-charitable in a sense. We think the political mobilization that can come out of those organizations is actually a plus. And we also think, just because part of the motivation for our proposal also, in addition to affecting, trying to change trends in long-run income inequality, is also just getting people more connected to their communities. The motivation is a little bit different. It's not just about subsidizing services through the nonprofit sector that, you know, otherwise government might provide. We think that part of the benefit of this proposal is for the people who are giving themselves and making them more deeply connected to their communities. And so for that purpose, it's less important whether the organization is a charity or not.
We'll have more with Andrew Hayashi and Justin Hopkins in a moment.
If you like what you're hearing, share it with friends and colleagues on social media. Use the hashtag FreshResearch or retweet the Nonprofit Times link, and you'll be eligible to win a book from the NPT Library. Another way for folks to find the show, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more than 30 years, the Nonprofit Times has been the leading business publication for nonprofit management. To subscribe, visit shopthenonprofittimes.com. You'll also find special issue coverage, relevant research like our salary and benefits report, and best nonprofits to work for, plus other special reports and webinars. And keep up with the latest breaking news and in-depth reporting at thenonprofittimes.com.
Do you think your organization is one of the best nonprofits to work for? Well, now you can prove it. Registration is underway for the 2022 Best Nonprofits to Work For Survey, a collaboration between the Nonprofit Times and Best Companies Group. The October deadline will be here before you know it, so visit bestnonprofitstoworkfor.com for more information and to register today.
And now, back to the charitable tax deduction and civic engagement with Andrew Hayashi and Justin Hopkins.
And it's not the first time that there's been a tax credit proposed. I think the paper cites some tax credit proposals that came up that allowed for a credit of up to $1,000 in contributions. I think it was in 2010 is what the paper cited. So it's come up in the past. It just hasn't gone anywhere yet as far as on the Hill.
Yeah, that's right. So there have been in the past credits, and also there was a time when non-itemizers could deduct as well. So and as you say, sort of most recently, just even in the last couple of years, we have this temporary measure, you know. I'm not a political scientist. I can't sort of read the tea leaves, but our I think our sense is that these concerns around sort of loss of community, particularly maybe in rural areas, are concerns shared by the political right and left. Maybe they speak about it in slightly different terms, or there's slightly different parts of the country where they're particularly worried about it. But our sense and our hope is that they're, you know, understood in these terms as having these benefits on communities and in civic engagement, that the politics might be a little bit better now than it has been in the past, just because these concerns about sort of community disintegration and also about inequality are more sort of acute than they've ever been before. But, you know, I can't prognosticate. We think this is good policy, but I don't know whether it, you know, has a better chance of succeeding than some of these other proposals.
Yeah, I think that was one thing that we talked about. And just to kind of touch base on that C3 versus C4 discussion earlier, is that, you know, when Andrew and I talked, we weren't necessarily as dedicated to the idea that, hey, there's a specific group of institutions for which this should apply. We were more interested in the fact that we want to bring in people from the lower income brackets. Because as Andrew explained, the tax incentives now primarily benefit only wealthier individuals or families. And so the main crux of it is to make it a credit as opposed to deduction to open it up to everyone. And in terms of the political dynamics, you know, I'm not a political scientist or political scholar either, but I think our sense is that there are aspects of this that appeal to both the left and the right. In addition to the idea of community engagement, I mean, who's not for that, right? Like across both sides of the aisle, I think parties would agree with the fact that it's something that we want to encourage. But more specifically and more nuanced, the concern about the charitable contribution from the left is that this deduction is primarily used by wealthy people to steer the nonprofit sector and to steer the priorities of the nonprofit sector. And to the extent that this shifts that trend and puts some of that control and some of the dollars in the hands of the lower income people in our communities, it somewhat helps to ameliorate the concern that, you know, an elite group of people are controlling this sector of the economy. And on the right, I think is typically more energized by the idea of local institutions and local organizations receiving funding as opposed to, you know, a broader federal government. And so the idea of devolving the funds and transferring resources to local communities away from sort of a large federal government is more appealing to the right, I think, as well as the idea that, you know, the nonprofit sector is, you know, widely accessed by the people on the right as well. I think I've seen surveys on that, but that's just kind of our feeling, is our hope is that it does reach across the aisle and it doesn't become a partisanship issue.
Well, yeah, that's true. And the other issue, I think, with some of these proposals in terms of deductions and credits is the balance of revenue lost to the federal government.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if $500 is going to the charity, then that's $500 that's not going to the federal government. And so that, you know, this is one of the concerns with any sort of spending or proposal of this nature, is that we've got to balance the costs with the benefits. There is a loss to the federal coffers, but what our feeling is that a lot of the services that are being done in the nonprofit sector are services that the federal government also supports. So the FDA supports the local food bank. And so that's an example of how the federal government works to support local charities. And so to some extent, this money is just shifting money from the federal government to the local sector, where resources can be potentially deployed in a more effective manner. Well, at least that's the argument that you'd hear more from people on the right. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Justin, I was just going to say, I mean, we don't, and Mark, we don't have a sort of a strong view about how to pay for this. I mean, we seem to be in a period in where we're talking about the next set of tax reforms. It seems like since 2017, we're always in a period of tax reform. So, you know, a lot of things are on the table. And I think there are, you know, I have my own views about federal tax law reform that could be used to pay for a proposal like this. And there's certainly no reason why extending a charitable giving credit would need to be paid for by other reforms to, for example, the charitable deduction. But we do talk about some of those ideas in the paper. So, you know, if one thought that this had to be entirely paid for within the by reforms to the charitable deduction, we discussed the effects of eliminating the fact you get a sort of full fair market value deduction for donations of things like stock, even appreciated stock, without paying a tax on the gain. You could reduce the amount of deductible contributions to a lower percentage of a taxpayer's adjusted gross income. There's sort of other changes we could make to help pay for it by reforms to the deduction. We just, you know, don't think that needs to be the only thing on the table. There's no reason in principle why this couldn't be paid for by, you know, a change in the corporate tax rate, for example, or changes to, you know, the basis step up at death, which has been in the news. There are lots of things on the table, but we do propose in the paper a couple of changes to the charitable deduction that might be used to pay for this.
And specifically, can you just break down what your proposal is and how it would impact the individual taxpayer?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we, you know, the details are important here. And it's something that we're, you know, we're still puzzling over a little bit, because what we want to do with the credit is not only to change sort of who the set of donors are to C3s and C4s, hoping to change the way that nonprofits, who their, you know, priorities and fundraising and so on, but we want to encourage people to make donations, but also to volunteer and then become more civically engaged. So I think that implementation details matter a lot, because if you think about extending a $500 refundable tax credit to a low-income household with the idea that you want them to give, and maybe it's and that credit is, say, 90% of the cash contribution a household makes to a nonprofit up to a donation of $500, say. Those are the numbers we pick in the paper. What that means right now is that, you know, that household has to come up with $500 over the course of the year to make the donation, and then they'll file a return in early of the following year in order to claim their refund. And so there's a real timing issue for low and middle income households. Where are you going to come up with the $500 that you'll get it back almost entirely, but not until you file your return? So there's a liquidity issue that we have to worry about if we really want to encourage people to make the donations and enjoy all the benefits that come from that. So what we currently propose is that actually when a taxpayer files her return, that she can claim the credit at that time for donations that she intends to make over the following year. So you say file your return on April 15th, and based on your income, you'd be entitled to a credit, a refundable credit of, say, $500, and you could claim it on that year's return, get the refund, and with the intent of donating that amount. Now, if you don't, in fact, make the donation, then that would affect your liability. You'd have to repay it for the following year. So that's sort of out of, there's sort of a 1 year advance, in a sense, that we're proposing be used, so that to make sure that everybody who's interested in making the donation actually has the cash on hand to do it. So that's sort of, there are other ways that you could imagine doing this. Households could have you could sort of just have a voucher. You could imagine designating a particular charity as a recipient of a $500 payment that could be made directly by the U.S. Treasury. We think that there's a benefit, and this is why we don't propose that the credit is 100% of the donation amount, actually. We think that there's some benefit to the donor having a little bit of skin in the game, so that the credit is not a full 100% of the amount of the donation. The donor comes up with some of the money out of pocket, so they feel a sense of investment in the charity. Because again, we think there's a benefit in encouraging people to become a little bit invested. They feel like they have some of their own money invested in the organization, so they take a greater interest. And we think the volunteerism and the civic engagement benefits are more likely to flow if the donor isn't just handing over the government's money, but is also contributing a little bit of their own.
So I think what I could add to that discussion is just sort of boil down a simple illustration that shows kind of the incentives that we're trying to hope to induce. maybe that's kind of hard to follow for maybe some of your listeners, but let's put it this way. So here's the way the current tax regime works. You know, you it's at the end of the year, it's April 15th. You collect all your receipts, W-2s, everything that you've received. You fill out your tax return, and let's say you owe $750. Okay, then what you do is you write a check to the IRS, the Treasury, for $750, and then you submit it along with your tax return, and that's that. Well, what we're proposing is that instead of submitting the $750 to the U.S. Treasury, a portion of that, let's say $500, you could submit to a local community organization. You could make a donation, and then for the remaining $250, you submit to the U.S. Treasury. And so what that does is that makes the taxpayer somewhat indifferent between supporting the local organization and submitting it to the Treasury. Now, what Andrew was talking about is we can't really make it a one-for-one contribution, because if you have the choice of either a $500 contribution to your food bank or a $500 contribution to your Treasury, then that's not really anything coming out of your pocket, because either way, you're going to have to pay $500. And so the idea is, if you pay $500 to the food bank, then you get $400 less to have to spend to the Treasury. And so that $100 or $50, or I don't think Andrew and I are really tied to the specifics of that, but part of that actually does fall on you. And so what this illustrates is, the importance of having it be less than the 100%, B, the taxpayer being incentivized to make the contribution, because either way, they're going to have to make a payment. It's whether it's to the Treasury or to the food bank. And then, like what Andrew also mentioned, is that the other complication is that you're doing this in April for behavior and transactions that occurred throughout the past year. And so there is the timing issue that in order to be eligible for the credit under normal circumstances, you'd have had to make the contribution before December 31st, and then you would get credit for it in April 15th. And so in order to ameliorate that timing issue where you have to pay it in advance, and then you get the deduction or you get the money back when you file your return, we are thinking about giving the taxpayer the benefit of the doubt and taking the credit on April 15th for contributions that he or she intends to make throughout that current year. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of how I think about it. We're just trying to make the taxpayer incentivized to think about their local organizations that they either have used in the past or are familiar with, because I think there's a good portion of people in our community who have never considered potentially donating to their local organizations because, you know, there's a lack of resources, that the money is tight. But if you provide this incentive to everybody, then all of a sudden you create sort of a whole new class of donor that, you know, Andrew referred to earlier, that now all of a sudden they have the ability to make contributions to these organizations, and maybe it's organizations that have helped them in the past. And so I think one of the beautiful aspects of this is it's the idea of maybe transforming a recipient or a client of a local nonprofit into an actual donor of it. And the idea that they would get involved in the operations and just provide a level of support and feedback that I think a lot of these organizations don't see.
Well, great. Professors, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having us. This is, it's been informative.
That's our episode for today. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share the Fresh Research link on Twitter or Facebook to be eligible to win something from the NPT Library. You can also share on social media with the hashtag Fresh Research. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times, spotlighting research and trends in the philanthropic sector. Till next time, keep up with us at thenonprofittimes.com for all your nonprofit news.